Chapter 9. A Small Glass of Wine. Hiding a Fugitive. The last chapter saw us in 17th century Japan, where both Yagyu and Takuan faced the tiger with the spontaneity and alacrity that are important aspects of true freedom. This time we remain in Japan, but we have moved forward to the 19th century as we look at another story from Trevor Leggett's The Tiger's Cave. This story, too, involves a life-threatening event. Many Zen stories deal with commonplace incidents, but because Zen focuses very directly on our existential situation and how we resolve the basic issue, life and death, it is particularly interested in situations where someone who has gained insight into reality through their Buddhist training faces death or danger. During this time in Japan, there are many civil disturbances. In one of the areas where there is much fighting and unrest is a Zen temple, whose abbot is called Bokusan. One day there is a skirmish between rival groups in the area, and one of the samurai on the losing side flees for his life. He knows his pursuers are not far behind him, and he desperately needs a refuge, a sanctuary from their swords, for if he is caught, he is dead. He immediately thinks of the Zen temple and its master. He makes all due haste to the temple and rushes into Bakusan's presence. The samurai is probably dishevelled from the fight. He may even be wounded. Bokusan at once agrees to hide him. I don't know where he puts him. Zen temples are quite Spartan, so there can't be many options. Bokusan goes back to his room. Shortly afterwards, three samurai from the winning side arrive. They have managed to track the fugitive. Perhaps they have followed a trail of blood, and they are certain he is somewhere in the temple. They are armed, and their blood is up from the chase, so they do not stand on ceremony. They demand that Bokusan turns their quarry over to them at once. Bokusan calmly replies, "There's no one here." They do not believe him for an instant. They have just been in a fight, they have followed the trail to this place, and they know their enemy is here. They are not prepared to be put off by anybody, not even a Zen master. So they say, "Right, if he won't tell us, we'll cut off your head." All three have long, sharp swords. Bokusan is unarmed, clad in a simple robe, and unless he leads them to the fugitive, they will certainly carry out their threat. How does he respond? He says, "Well, if I am to die, I think I'll have a glass of wine." Going to a little cupboard, he takes out a small bottle of wine and a glass. Maybe he was given the wine by one of the temple's supporters for a special occasion, and he reckons that his death is a special occasion. In any case, it will be his last chance to taste it. Bokusan sits down, opens the bottle, and very mindfully, with a steady hand, pours himself some wine. Not a big glass, just a small one. He sniffs the wine appreciatively and begins drinking, slowly and happily, savouring each mouthful. Very good. He becomes totally absorbed in enjoying his glass of wine. Eventually it is finished. No, he shouldn't really have a second one just because he's going to die. There's no need to get carried away. So he puts down the glass, looks around, and the three men have gone. The three samurai have been watching this man, whom they have threatened with imminent execution, drinking a glass of wine with total unconcern. He is not engaging with them at all, and they do not know what to do. There is something unnerving about the stillness, the total concentration with which he drinks his wine and savours it. They are nonplussed. Finally, they look at one another and leave him unharmed. House Styles of Enlightenment. This is our quite simple story. It is another situation where someone who has been practicing Buddhism over many years and has found freedom through it faces death. However, Bokusan's response is the complete opposite of Takuan's in the last chapter. Faced with a dangerous situation, Takuan met it head on. He leapt into the tiger's world, confronted death directly, and made friends with it. Bokusan remains entirely on his own ground, quite unruffled and unconcerned. He does not enter the world of the samurai. He remains aloof like Mount Fuji, so that they cannot get a foothold anywhere. Perhaps if Bakusan had met the tiger, he would have strolled into its cage, sat down with his back to the beast, and completely ignored it. How can we account for these two very different approaches? Anyone who has deep insight into reality will be unpredictable because they have broken the grip of habitual tendencies. They are free in each moment, so you cannot predict their actions. This does not mean they are unreliable. It means they are spontaneous. You never quite know where they're going to jump to next because they have such a range of possibilities. Nonetheless, people will still have a style through which they express their insight. This style will depend on their personality and spiritual training. Something we have to take into account when considering the different responses of Takuan and Bakusan is that they come from different schools of Zen Buddhism. Takuan follows the tradition known as the Rinzai school, which began in 9th century China. Perhaps its greatest exponent in Japan was Hakuin, who lived in the 18th century. Hakuin was an extraordinary person, a painter, calligrapher, and sculptor, as well as a great meditator, and he had a very dramatic spiritual life. He claimed he had 18 major insights into reality, and more minor ones than he could really count. This is in keeping with the whole style of Rinzai Zen, powerful and dramatic. Rinzai himself was the Chinese founder of the school. He used dramatic methods of teaching, shouting, even hitting people, trying to shock them awake from the sleep of ignorance. The Rinzai school became very popular in Japan at the emperor's court and among the samurai. Its direct, dramatic approach suited men who were regularly faced with life or death situations. The Rinzai school mainly taught through koans, which are existential problems upon which you meditate to take you beyond rational thought to a deeper level of your experience. Knowing something of the Rinzai style, we should not be surprised that Takuan, when asked to meet a tiger, took a strikingly direct approach. Bakusan, on the other hand, comes from the Soto school, the other major school of Zen in Japan. There is also the Obaku school, but this has not been as influential as Soto and Rinzai. Soto Zen was brought to Japan by Dogen, who lived between 1200 and 1253, and it varies in some respects from the Rinzai method. Rinzai emphasizes sudden enlightenment. It works to build up pressure. To practice it, you need great faith, but also what is known as great doubt, an existential question that burns inside you like a molten ball, which you can neither swallow down nor vomit up. Rinzai uses meditation on koans to catalyze this experience. Spurred on by the faith that there is an answer which will resolve your existential question, you practice with increasing intensity until you make a breakthrough, like a flash of lightning, which illuminates the darkness of your ignorance, and suddenly you see, this is how things are. Dogen's is a more gradual approach. He considered that straining, all this huffing and puffing after enlightenment, is an expression of one's ego on a more subtle level, strengthening the illusion that there is somewhere to go, something you're going to attain as your possession. So he emphasized what is called shikan taza in Japanese, which means just sitting. In meditation, rather than using a koan to break through, you just sit, aware, steady, composed, and contented. And if there is anything to attain, it matures like a ripening fruit. Dogen considered that meditating in this aware but purposeless way was itself an expression of your Buddha nature, your deepest potential. The Soto school became the largest Zen tradition in Japan, and it appealed to the common people, for want of a better term, particularly in rural areas. So perhaps Bakusan too responds in the way to which his training has predisposed him, very steady and undramatic, just continuing to pay attention to the details of life. Even when three people say they're going to cut off your head, You calmly carry on, unruffled, unconcerned. There is no reason for any histrionics. If Bokusan is going to die, then he will have a glass of wine. Drinking it is a perfect expression of things as they really are. It is all quite matter of fact. Dealing with information vacuums. What can we learn about the human condition and the path to freedom by putting ourselves into this story? Firstly, what links both Takuan and Bokusan is that, although their responses to crucial situations are very different in expression, they both stay absolutely in the moment, giving themselves up 100% to the here and now. Takuan leaps completely focused into the tiger's cage. Bokusan pours his glass of wine and then brings all his awareness to the experience, totally absorbed, savouring that drink to the point where the three samurai and their threat have completely disappeared. Their ability to live in the present frees these men from many of the fears and anxieties that ordinary people suffer. After all, dying is not in the present moment, it is in the future. Whilst it does seem that there can be an instinctive fear which comes from the body, most fear comes from this tendency to project ourselves into the future, thinking, will I be all right, or what's going to become of me? This is a constant human tendency. Whilst it is quite natural to wonder what is to become of us, Buddhism, as we have seen, denies that there is really a fixed, unchanging self that has gone through all our experiences and whose existence we can project into the future. Our capacity to imagine the future is a mixed blessing. Employed creatively, it allows us to envisage new possibilities, to plan effectively, and to avoid pitfalls. Less positively, it can be used to fill our time with daydreams and fantasies. These are usually a waste of time. We can work against this tendency through practices such as meditation on the breath, which reduce anxiety and tension and strengthen our awareness. But we can also use our ability to project into the future in a way that causes us a great deal of unnecessary suffering. We do this by filling what I call information vacuums with our own imaginings. For example, sometimes I give a series of talks. If there was a good turnout for the first one, as I travel to give the second in the series, I could find myself thinking, well, I wonder how many people there will be. It would be really very embarrassing if after my first talk there were only about 5 people. It's a sunny day, people may have been hot all day at work or at home. Then, thinking of the stuffiness of the lecture hall, they may decide not to come. I could picture talking to a pitiful handful of bored faces, and make myself miserable. Alternatively, I could imagine that many people appreciated my first talk and will decide to come again, so that I shall be addressing in a packed room. The reality is I do not know what is going to happen. We cannot predict the future, and we human beings usually find this uncertainty very difficult. We find it hard not to fill the vacuum with imaginings, and often what we imagine causes us pain. We may take an exam and then imagine ourselves failing. Indeed, our minds may circle around the topic so that we see ourselves failing this exam over and over again. Then, if we hear we have passed, we realize that we have put ourselves through all that pain completely unnecessarily. Or we may have a child who is taking their exams and imagine them failing. It is the same process. Or a close friend whom we had arranged to meet at a certain time doesn't turn up. After an hour, they still have not appeared, and we start thinking they have been run over, or they have deserted us. Or we get a bit of a headache, and if we have a tendency to hypochondria, before we know it, we are certain we have a fatal brain tumour. If we look at the number of times throughout our lives we have put ourselves through the pain of imagining terrible things that never actually happened because we couldn't bear to leave the vacuum of not knowing unfilled, and then we multiply it by all the billions of people in the world, the total represents a huge mass of completely unnecessary suffering. Surely there is enough actual suffering in life without us multiplying it by needless and painful imaginings? And all this comes about because we just cannot think, well, I don't know what is going to happen. Therefore, it is important to stay alert in situations where there is an information vacuum and to allow yourself not to know. Or, if that is really asking too much, at least you can practice filling that space with something positive. Imagine your child passing the exam rather than failing. Decide that this headache is really something very minor, which will probably clear up by tomorrow, rather than the beginning of something terminal. One of the six main practices of a bodhisattva is the development of kshanti, patience. An important aspect of patience is accepting the fact that we do not know until we find out. We cannot be sure what the future will bring. We cannot predict when death will come. All we can do is work in the present to set up the best conditions for the future. In particular, we can work to practice the Dharma and follow the path to freedom. If we make efforts now to become more substantial people, more emotionally positive, calm and energetic, then whatever the future brings, we shall have the resources to deal with it. In Bokusan's position, we would cause ourselves a great deal of suffering by leaping off into the future and fearfully imagining the worst, whereas he stays in the present, savouring his glass of wine. He does not send his mind on ahead to imagine what it feels like to be struck by a samurai sword. Giving up all claim on the world. Naturally, people were very interested in this incident, and Bokusan was often asked about it. Usually he would not discuss it, except on one occasion, when he said, "Well, there is something to be learned from it. When those fellows came, I did not do what they wanted, but neither did I quarrel with them or plead with them. I just gave up their whole world and had nothing to do with them. And after a time, I found they had gone away." Similarly, when people complain that they are overwhelmed with passions and wrong thoughts, they should know that the right way is not to quarrel, nor to plead or argue. Simply give up all claim on their world and have nothing to do with them, and after a time you will find that they have gone away. Bokusan here points to two different aspects of freedom, two arenas in which we can practice this giving up all claim on the world. There is freedom in relation to the outside world and other people, which culminates in giving up reliance on the everyday world altogether. Then there is freedom in relation to our own mental states, particularly finding ways of avoiding being overwhelmed by those which are negative. In this section, we shall look more generally at what is involved in giving up a world. In the following sections, we shall explore it in more practical details. To see how we can give up all claim on the world, it is important to understand the mechanism by which we steer our way through life. From the raw material of our experience, we are all the time selecting certain features on which to concentrate. This happens largely unconsciously, based on our assumptions and preconceptions, as well as our habitual tendencies. Through this process, we fashion a world for ourselves. This world is particular to us, though it overlaps with the worlds of other human beings, who are all making their own particular selection from the raw material of experience. Although we have produced it through our choices, the world we live in tends to present itself to us in absolute terms. We experience it as how things are. Our views and assumptions lead us to create a world because they largely determine the choices we have made. Take the example of Paul, a young executive moving quickly up the promotion ladder, who has just got a new job. Driving his workhorse Ford into the car park for a first meeting at his new office, he notices that he is surrounded by Audis, BMWs, and the occasional Mercedes. He soon discovers that cars are important icons of status and success among his new colleagues. Before long, he is buried deep in the motoring magazines, quickly followed by a tour of the car dealers to trade in his old Ford, to emerge eventually with something many thousands of pounds more expensive, which allows him to hold up his head in the office car park. Having absorbed his colleagues' values, cars now feature much larger in his world. "What do you drive?" is a question he often asks new business acquaintances, and to a degree he judges them by their answer. Meanwhile, he is sacrificing other activities in order to save up for something even shinier that will really impress them at work. In this way, Paul starts by changing his views from seeing cars as useful means of transport to seeing them as status icons. This leads him to make choices in which cars play a much larger part in his world. After a few more years of reading car magazines and looking at what other people are driving, it feels natural to Paul for cars to be important in this way. Of course, many of the most enticing worldviews are offered to us by people trying to sell us something, be it a new car or an old political ideology. In the case of the latest consumer goodies, quite often they are presented to us as things we must have. How on earth are we going to live without a faster computer, designer-labeled clothes, or whatever it may be? But if we step back from that worldview as it presents itself to us and ask ourselves, do I really need these things and all those other things that will in future become essentials? In buying the latest consumer necessity, we are very often not just purchasing an object that will perform a particular function, we are also buying into a view that happiness in life comes from consumerism. Can you really shop your way to freedom? The consumerist view of the world is relatively easy to see through. It often affects us more by attrition, by sheer weight of numbers, all the advertisements, media images, and so on that we are subjected to in the course of a week, than because the arguments for it are very compelling. However, there are other, much deeper views which are harder to see through, particularly if they have been part of our emotional furniture since we were very young. For instance, Paul's girlfriend Vicky was always taught by her mother, from her own bitter experience with her husband, that you cannot trust men. As a result, this has become an article of faith with Vicky, who consequently never feels really secure with Paul. As well as having arguments about the fact that Paul doesn't take her out so often these days because he is saving for a new car, the couple have much more serious rows about the fact that Vicky never trusts Paul when he is out of her sight. Paul has always been faithful, but he feels increasingly caged and restive under Vicky's repeated cross-examinations. As time goes on, tensions around this issue begin to seriously affect their relationship, and Paul eventually finds himself, without quite meaning to, in the arms of a secretary at work. When Vicky finds out, there is an explosion, and she naturally concludes that her mother was right all along. Most of the filters of views and opinions through which we see the world and which make things feel right to us come from our conditioning. We have absorbed them from a young age, often by osmosis, from the people around us. Practice of the Dharma is extremely radical because it involves bringing into sharp awareness the assumptions behind the worldviews we were given by our families and schooling, our national, racial, gender and class backgrounds, as well as those offered us all the time by the media and advertising industries. By challenging all that is false in those assumptions, we can see things in a different way and begin making new choices, no longer creating a painful or limited world based on an untrue or partial vision of how things are. We move into a world in which we are increasingly free. This is no easy practice. It requires deep self-knowledge to catch views about ourselves and our life with which we have grown up. It is as if we have been looking at life through spectacles that we never knew we were wearing. Ways of becoming more conscious of these assumptions include meditation, which gives us increased self-awareness, friendship, through which we can have our views and tendencies sympathetically reflected back to us, and the study of the Dharma. Studying Buddhism with other people is particularly effective. Through this, we bring our views and ideas into juxtaposition with an enlightened perspective in a situation in which others can point out to us where we are avoiding or misunderstanding. Through using these methods, we gain increasing choice about how we live, and we work to consciously decide the principles on which we wish to base our lives. To help us to develop the clarity to see the assumptions behind what we are usually being offered by our environment, it can be very helpful to give ourselves a respite from it from time to time. This is one of the reasons why Buddhists try to go away regularly on retreat, taking time out to meditate, study the Dharma, and reflect, ideally away from our usual surroundings. As well as giving us a chance to meditate in peaceful conditions, a retreat gives us a chance to look at our experience afresh, to see beyond our current worlds, and find new possibilities based on better assumptions. Whether we are on retreat or not, we need to remain aware, to keep examining the views of life we are being offered by the culture around us, looking at them in the light of our core values. In this way, we shall leave behind group values and become more truly individual, like some great tree growing clear of the forest canopy, stretching up into the sunlight, too big to be used or manipulated. This is what happened with Bokusan. The samurai assumed they had power over him, that their swords gave them a great deal of negotiating leverage. But Bokusan had left their world behind. He was no longer operating on the same assumptions as they were. So they had no significant power over him, no way of affecting him. He had grown out of their world, in which force was the final arbiter. He had gone beyond being manipulated. His course through life was no longer decided by pleasure or pain, being praised or blamed, gaining or losing, whether he was famous or had a bad reputation. Bokusan had become far too big for the samurai. If he was a tree, their swords would leave barely an impression on his bark. Two different approaches to difficulties. Let's look more closely at what this means for us, day to day, in our efforts to move towards freedom. I said that Takuan and Bokusan were united by the fact that they both stayed aware in the moment. At the same time, they do represent two very different approaches in terms of spiritual development. Takuan confronts a problem or a situation head-on, and in a way he represents all those times when we need to do that, when we have to confront the tiger, either within ourselves or in an external situation. Whatever the tiger may be in our own life, we look it straight in the eye. You can meet situations and people directly. You can confront your own difficulties and negative tendencies head-on. Or you can do the reverse, which is Bokusan's approach. It is almost as if he turns his back on the tiger. He does not put any energy into these three people. As for their threat to cut off his head, he does not give it any time. He does not engage with it at all, and after a time, he finds they have gone away. The Japanese admire courage and a spirit that refuses to bow to circumstance, so they do not carry out their threat. So we have these two approaches. Sometimes we might confront a situation or difficulty head-on, at other times we might not apply any energy at all and allow it to wither away. We have to be able to use both, skillfully and strategically, as appropriate. Let's suppose that in meditation one day you are faced with some strong distraction. What can you do about it? There are different approaches you can take. Firstly, you can confront the distraction. You can leave aside the object of your concentration, which you are not concentrating on very well anyway, and look objectively at the distraction and see its consequences. Perhaps you are thinking badly about somebody. Think where that could lead. You confront that tendency in yourself. You look at it with very cool awareness, and you work to change it, to move it on. Secondly, you might decide not to engage with the distraction. To start with, you can try putting more energy into focusing on your concentration object. If that is unsuccessful, you can adopt what is often called a sky-like attitude, treating the distraction like a cloud passing across the clear blue sky of your mind. The distraction is there like a cloud, but you identify with the broader expanse of your consciousness. Within that broad awareness, the cloud of distraction can stay or go as it pleases. You are not caught up with it. You know the distraction is there, but you do not feed it any energy. You give up its world. Both these approaches can be valid and useful, and it is important to know which to use in a particular situation, whether to confront the tiger or to leave it alone. How do we decide? The tiger here is a very broad symbol. It might be an aspect of ourselves, difficult feelings or behaviour, or it might be a problem with someone or something outside ourselves. People like Takuan and Bokusan, men and women who have gained some insight into reality, act spontaneously. They do not have to work out which approach to take. On another day, if you had asked Takuan to go and see the tiger, he might not have run down to the cage. He might have strolled down there, perhaps eating an apple on the way, and offered the core to the tiger and patted it on the head. Every day would be different. But our spontaneity has not yet arrived at that level, so we need some kind of guideline until we can follow our spiritual intuition completely. There are a few points to be made about this. Dustbin psychology. The first point is that, probably these days, popular psychology weighs quite heavily on the side of confronting the tiger. By popular psychology, I mean the kind of amateur psychology that people trade with each other in bars and during coffee breaks at work. This is often based on a Chinese whispers Freudianism to give a very unsubtle model of how human beings function. At its worst, popular psychology spawns suggestions like the following. You have had various difficult life experiences which have accumulated in your mind like the contents of a dustbin. What you have to do is get your hand right down into the dustbin and pull something out. Look at it again, re-experience it, throw it away, and then find another one. Repeat the process, and if you keep going down long enough, you will get to the bottom of the dustbin. You will have cleared out everything from the past, and you will feel wonderful. That is a very crude model of the mind and how to work with it. Certainly, unpleasant incidents have happened to all of us, but for Buddhism, a human being is more like an empty stage on which feelings and actions arise depending on conditions. That does not mean that under the right conditions certain habitual patterns will be triggered, but it does not imply that there is an irreducible quantity of past difficulties that you have to sift through in order to feel happy. People who believe in the dustbin model face an impossible task. At times, bringing awareness to past painful events may release energy. But if you keep on focusing attention on those events, you perpetuate them. You set up the conditions for them to continue to arise. Rather than reducing the amount of trash in the dustbin, you can end up reinforcing a pattern of precipitating yourself into painful mental states. I am not writing off psychology. There are certain painful experiences that have deeply affected people and which they need to explore. But this popular view, which suggests that anything you do not confront is going to fester somewhere in the unconscious depths of your mental dustbin and cause trouble later, is not the Buddhist view. I am not advocating repression either. It is obviously not good if something is part of your experience and you unconsciously prevent yourself from experiencing it. However, you do not have to go to the other extreme and explore all the psychological ramifications of your difficulties or problems. Sometimes you can just let them go. Popular psychology is overweighting the balance in favour of Takuan's approach, scaring us with the idea that if we do not confront the tiger, there will be trouble. But the tiger of the emotions is not a real tiger which is constantly lurking, waiting to cause trouble unless we confront it. Rather, it is a dream tiger that only arises in dependence upon certain conditions. Changing the problem by changing your level of consciousness. Bokusan adopts a different kind of approach to his situation. He deals with it by changing levels. The samurai are trying to corner him by saying, "Either you give up this fugitive or we cut off your head." In response, Bokusan does not operate on their level. Instead, he moves into a world of aesthetic appreciation. It is not high-level aesthetic appreciation. It is a glass of wine, but it is still aesthetic appreciation. They are trying to manipulate him to do something. He just does not play. The point that I want to make here is that changing your level of consciousness is doing something about the problem or situation. We have all had the experience of trying to do some work when we are a bit tired and irritable. Maybe you are working with a computer, trying to get something done, and because you are tired, you do not make a very good job of it. It all takes far longer than it ought to, and actually the best thing would be to stop, go for a walk, or have a cup of tea, and come back refreshed. You would then solve your problem more easily. Plodding on in your current state of mind is a very ineffective way of trying to solve a problem. In fact, it can become counterproductive. This kind of everyday experience demonstrates that even a little shift, a little change of consciousness, can make a difference to a problem. A major shift of consciousness, such as one can make if one meditates regularly and practices the Dharma, can make a radical difference. Because we often tend to think of our problems and difficulties as something given, they become absolute. When we are in them, that is how they are, and that is how we are. But if we change our level of consciousness, we change the context. Therefore, we change the problem. It is a bit like a house with a number of floors. If you move up a floor, there is different furniture. If you raise your level of consciousness, then your mental furniture may still be reminiscent of the lower levels, but it is brighter and there is more space around it. If you observe yourself closely, you will notice that there are some problems and difficulties that dominate your thinking when you are on a certain level of consciousness, which do not seem to be there when you are in a better state. Perhaps you go on retreat and practice more meditation than usual. In doing so, you transcend your previous level of consciousness. In that higher state, the problem vanishes. Oh, that! Yes! I was worried about that before I went on retreat, wasn't I? People like Bokusan and Takuan have gained changed levels so drastically up to the point of transcendental insight that even the problem of birth and death has vanished without trace. Sometimes, rather than banging our heads against some intractable aspect of ourselves or some seemingly insoluble problem, we would do best to change the context. In particular, we can try to expand our awareness. The problem may not go away, but it will be much easier to resolve on a different level. It can be useful in this regard to make a distinction between difficulties and problems. A difficulty, in the sense I'm using it here, is something that can be solved on its own level, whereas a problem cannot. A problem, defined in this way, requires a shift of consciousness, a change of context, before it can be solved. Sometimes people will present you with dilemmas that are insoluble on their own terms. On the level of their dilemma, it is as if there is furniture everywhere, one piece piled on another, with everything crammed so closely together that it could never be disentangled, and there is no room for manoeuvre. There is no solution on the level on which the issue is being presented. You can spend hours talking to someone about such a problem, and by the end they are often very pleased and grateful to you for spending so much time discussing what to do, but nothing has actually changed. Rather than relating to someone on the basis of their problems, it is often better to try to widen their emotional horizons by affirming the healthier parts of their experience. Facing the tiger or leaving it alone. If we bear these points in mind, we shall be in a better position to decide between our two strategies, facing the tiger or leaving it alone. As usual in Buddhism, the decision depends on our motivation. Why do we want to confront this particular tiger? We might want to do so for quite negative reasons. For instance, we might be too anxious or impatient to be able to let things be. Sometimes people can be very decisive for the wrong reasons. I have been in groups where we were wondering what to do about some matter, and someone would say very definitely, "Oh yes, we need to do this, this, and this." Everyone else, impressed with the confidence of their assertion, would go along with it. Later it turned out that their confident proposals were completely wrong, and I was left wondering how come they seemed so certain about it. People sometimes act in this way because they cannot bear not knowing what to do. Rather than living with the uncertainty, they clutch at the first solution that occurs to them. This often looks like real leadership and decisiveness, but it has actually come out of, I can't stand this, let's do something. Confronting the tiger on that basis will not be very useful or effective. Alternatively, facing the tiger could be based on positive mental states. For instance, it could arise out of care for someone. There could be a situation in which you feel great concern for a friend, so you leap in and meet them, engaging them with all the energy you have available. Or it could come from a desire to make a positive change in yourself, to resolve something which really does need resolving. We have to be aware and honest with ourselves. What is our motivation? Why are we putting energy into this situation? Are we acting out of anxiety or restlessness, or from a genuine desire to make a difference? The same questions apply to deciding to give up the tiger's world. We may be holding back out of fear or a sort of aloof pride, or from lack of concern, we may have created what a friend of mine once called somebody else's problem field, as in, look, that tiger is about to break out of its cage. Somebody ought to do something about it. We keep our distance, not wanting to become involved. Many people in the West like to look cool and detached and score points with their friends for doing so, but this often means they are not really engaging with life. We may also decide, from very positive motives, that we will not put energy into some situation. We may think the best way to resolve some negative aspect of ourselves is to starve it of energy, widen our sphere of interest, and grow beyond the problem. If we grow beyond it, it will become smaller in relation to the rest of us, so we may decide quite positively to change the problem by changing the level or context in which we face it. We need to be careful when taking decisions of this kind. It is not as if there is an absolute rule, always do this, always do that. No one can provide us with that. It is one of those aspects of the path to freedom with which we need to experiment to see what works and to learn from our mistakes. It also helps if we can become aware of our habitual tendencies. Some people habitually avoid. They keep their options open because of an underlying fear or lack of engagement. Others habitually confront out of tension, their inability to let things rest. Whatever we do, whether we decide to face the tiger or leave it alone, we must do it wholeheartedly. For instance, if we have tried unsuccessfully to give up the tiger's world, then we should resolutely engage with it. The main thing, as a Zen saying goes, is don't wobble. Is the Zen master a liar and a drunkard? We have now explored some of the lessons of our story, but there may be a couple of doubts about Bokusan lingering in your mind, which I had better try to dispel. To put it bluntly, in facing the tiger style, is he a liar and a drunkard? When the three samurai claim he is hiding a fugitive, Bokusan says, there's no one here. Isn't that a lie? Now you could argue that he is only telling a white lie in order to save someone's life, which is a reasonable thing to do. But in a way, he is not lying at all. He is talking on another level of truth, from the viewpoint of ultimate reality, on which there are no fixed, unchanging entities, just a flow of different processes. So from that understanding, when Bokusan says there's no one here, it is true. However, it is a truth that the three samurai cannot understand. What about that glass of wine? The fifth of the basic Buddhist precepts is to abstain from intoxicants that dull the mind. In addition, the moment of death is considered by most Buddhist traditions a crucial time in which to remain aware. So why does Bokusan want to drink wine and cloud his awareness when he is facing death? It must be said that Buddhists interpret the fifth precept in different ways. Some take it that you should never take any drink or drugs that cloud the mind, except where really necessary for medical reasons. Others consider it okay to take the occasional glass of something, provided you do not become unmindful. Unfortunately, some Buddhist teachers in the West have themselves fallen prey to drink, and have sometimes even tried to rationalize their actions in terms of the Dharma. Even if they themselves are not affected adversely by their alcohol consumption, which is frankly unlikely, we, who are not that spiritually developed, should not be trying to emulate them in this regard. The path to freedom involves maintaining as much awareness as possible in all situations. The use of drink and drugs defeats that purpose. If after we have had a drink or two we are not fit to be in charge of a car, we are also not fit to be in charge of our minds, which from the point of view of our quest for freedom is the most vital requirement of all. So if we are going to drink or take drugs socially, we have to be very honest with ourselves about the effect they have on our consciousness. We also have to take into account the fact that, in the case of alcohol and other drugs, we are supporting a multi-million pound industry that produces a vast number of alcoholics and drug addicts. Even when people are not actually alcoholic, heavy drinking has many negative consequences for our health. Experts estimate that alcohol is a factor in one-third of all hospital admissions in the UK. Even if we are certain that we shall not fall into such states, do we really want to give our money to organisations that are implicated in creating so much suffering? In the next chapter we shall see an example of the trouble drink can cause when we have to deal with a drunken samurai. But perhaps we should not become too concerned about Bokusan having a drink at this point. After all, he is a realized Buddhist master, and presumably he is not drinking the wine for its effect on his mind. He wants to savour something in what may be the last moments of his life, before disappearing from this level of experience. It is quite extraordinary that he is not drinking to summon up Dutch courage. He is doing it for some aesthetic enjoyment, admittedly on rather a low level. That was our small glass of wine, which can give us a taste of some new possibilities of living in the moment and not filling information vacuums with fears, anxieties, and negative thoughts, of not accepting the world on its own terms, but growing beyond it through awareness, through practice of the Dharma, until at last we are too big to be used or manipulated, of the development of awareness, so that we can either fully confront things or leave them completely alone, changing the problem by changing the context, particularly by changing our level of consciousness. It can give us a taste of what it would be like to pour ourselves into meditation, into practicing the Dharma so deeply, enjoying it so much, concentrating so strongly, that we finally reach a point where all our worries and troubles, all our fears, even our fear of death, have gone away. This is not simply a story of patience and unruffled equanimity, nor is it only a story of deep concentration, although Bokusan does become totally immersed, not literally, in his glass of wine. It is not even just a story about insight that goes beyond life and death. It is a true story of deep compassion, for Bokusan has risked his life to save the hidden fugitive. Presumably, the man is hiding somewhere in the temple, listening for the sound of his three pursuers coming to hunt him out. However, instead of the samurai, he hears the soft padding of Bokusan's straw sandals coming to tell him the coast is clear. Perhaps after the fugitive's frightening wait, he will be in need of a glass of wine.